This is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Friday, January 18th. I'm John Wanamaker. The tax debate at the state capitol this session is expected to include proposals aimed specifically at lowering property taxes. Democrats in the Minnesota House have already introduced a property tax refund measure among their early priority bills. Meanwhile, DFL Governor Mark Dayton will announce his approach next week as part of a broader tax reform plan. Tim Pugmire reports.
House DFL leaders have signaled they intend to follow through on one of their big campaign promises by proposing some direct property tax relief to middle-class homeowners and renters. It was the second House bill introduced. DFL Representative Jim Dabney of Minneapolis said his bill expands the renter's credit and the existing homeowner's property tax refund, which paid out about $272 million to 363,000 Minnesotans in 2011.
There's some income thresholds in the existing property tax refund program. We're tweaking those slightly so that we expand the program and more people get a little bit more in property tax relief. We've seen property taxes going up and up for a lot of Minnesotans, and we want to pull those back.
Dabney's plan would make people with higher household incomes eligible for the refunds. It would also increase the amount of the refunds. And the bill would try to boost participation by requiring the Department of Revenue to notify homeowners that they're eligible for refunds. Dabney estimated the cost of the expansion at nearly $100 million, which he expects to be part of the final tax package passed this session. Republican Representative Greg Davids of Preston said he too favors lower property taxes, but he believes the DFL proposal would be nothing more than a tax shift. Davids said he's worried the Democrats will want to pay for the refunds through an income tax increase.
That's very, very problematic because if you increase income taxes, you have less money in the economy to create jobs. So it's very problematic on where they're going to get the money from.
Next week, Governor Dayton is expected to propose a comprehensive reworking of the tax code alongside of his two-year budget plan. Dayton's Revenue Commissioner, Myron Franz, has spent most of the past year highlighting an imbalance among the current sources of state tax revenue, due largely to a 20% growth in property taxes statewide over the past decade. Franz wouldn't say what's in or out of the governor's tax plan, but he did say the House property tax refund proposal was among many ideas considered.
When we laid everything on the table, that was clearly one of the things we laid on the table. How can we deliver property tax relief to people that will really be effective and make a difference? And those programs do offer opportunities, but they also are somewhat limited in the way that they do that. So the challenge is, are those programs sufficiently broad enough to provide the kind of property tax relief that the people in Minnesota are really looking for?
DFL leaders in the Minnesota Senate did not include property tax relief among their first batch of bill introductions, but it's still an issue they plan to take up. Senate Tax Committee Chair Rod Scoy of Clearbrook said he agrees that property taxes are too high.
It's a very regressive tax, not related to one's ability to pay. And so I think we should look at making our tax system more fair. To me, that means stamping that leg down a little bit.
But Scoy is not ready to talk specifics about what bills might or might not come forward in his committee. He said he'll wait for the governor's tax proposal and then let the legislative process play out. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
There is a chance that Minnesota will see above normal precipitation in February, March, and April, but as we hear from reporter Mark Stile, it might not be enough to end the drought.
Forecasters at the U.S. Climate Prediction Center say cool Pacific Ocean temperatures may help set up a large low-pressure area over the western or central U.S. Meteorologist Anthony Artusa says if that trough develops, it would likely steer more moist southern air into the upper Midwest through the end of April.
There is an enhanced likelihood for the upper Mississippi Valley, including Minnesota, to see above median precipitation totals.
He says if the precipitation arrives, it probably would not be heavy enough to be called a drought buster. All of Minnesota is abnormally dry right now. Extreme drought covers the southwest corner of the state and a smaller area in the northwest. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Worthington.
Somalia's new president will urge his Somali-born compatriots in Minneapolis today to help rebuild their homeland, Laura Ewan reports.
President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud's visit comes just a day after Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced the U.S. is formally recognizing the Somali government for the first time in more than two decades. Mohamud is coming to Minnesota to address the nation's largest Somali diaspora community. He told the Center for Strategic and International Studies that despite more than 20 years of civil war, his country is safer now. And he made a direct appeal to Somali Americans.
Your technical know-how, your expertise is what we need. The dilemma we Somalis, both diaspora and those who are inside Somalia, we're facing is that you guys, you are waiting stable Somalia so that you can go back. And Somalia is waiting you to stabilize. So which comes first?
Mohamud is expected to address a crowd of thousands at the Minneapolis Convention Center.
That's reporter Laura Ewan. Federal officials have given a developer the green light to move ahead with a controversial wind project in southeastern Minnesota. If approved, it would be the first time a wind farm has been given permission to legally kill bald eagles. Elizabeth Baer has the story.
The proposed New Era wind farm would build 48 turbines on about 50 square miles of land in Goodhue County, not far from the Mississippi River. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimates the area is home to more than 400 bald eagles. In a letter to state officials this week, the Fish and Wildlife Service said the developer could apply for a special permit that would allow the project to go ahead, while acknowledging that some bald eagles might be killed. The federal agency said, at most, the proposed wind turbines might kill between 8 and 14 bald eagles per year. That's a worst-case scenario number, according to Fish and Wildlife Service field supervisor Tony Sullins. He says losing that number of bald eagles would not harm the bird's overall population.
Even that worst-case scenario in this local area would not damage the eagle population. It would not damage the local eagle population, nor would we damage the regional or national population.
Sullen says because of that, the federal agency will now be able to consider the so-called Eagle Take permit application from the project's developers. The company still has to prove to federal officials it'll comply with various mitigation measures. Some of those include cleaning up roadkill and other tempting targets for eagles to discourage them from flying near the turbines, as well as turning off the turbines when there's a concentration of eagles in the area. Sullins says if the Eagle Take permit is approved, it would allow the wind farm to kill a certain number of eagles every year without penalty. He says it's still unclear what that exact number would be.
One thing we're pretty confident of is that it will be less than the estimate we provided this week, so less than the 8 to 14 figure.
The Fish and Wildlife Service also estimates the risk to golden eagles is low, saying about one or two may be killed over the 30-year life of the project. Golden eagles are less common in Minnesota than bald eagles. But because there are no permits for killing golden eagles in Minnesota, Sullen says it would be a prosecutable federal offense if one died because of a turbine. Still, New Era wind owner Peter Mastick says he welcomes the Fish and Wildlife Service's decision to let the application move forward. Mastick declined to comment on tape for this story, but said the company has already submitted its Eagle Take permit application with the federal agency. Mastick said the turbine project is also pending approval from the state's Public Utilities Commission for an avian and bat protection plan, and it's waiting for approval from two local townships in Goodhue County. The project was initially called AWA Goodhue Wind, and it's been in the works for more than 4 years now. It's been met with fierce opposition from residents and neighbors, who say turbines don't belong in an area of the state with such a high eagle population.
If they kill two birds, I think it's a crime.
Steve Groth is with the Coalition for Sensible Siting, a group that has long opposed the wind farm project in southeastern Minnesota. He says he's disappointed with the Fish and Wildlife Service's decision to let the company move forward with the application.
I live out there. There isn't a day that goes by when I don't see several bald eagles in and about and around my home. And when you go further in different areas, they are more abundant there as well. There's a lot of beautiful birds out there. And to think, how can they estimate the death and how many they're going to take?
The Fish and Wildlife Service is still months away from making its final decision on the project's permit application. And the decision from the state's Public Utilities Commission on the bird and bat protection plan is expected sometime mid to late February. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
And this is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Women are a growing market for gun sales in this country, but a gender gap persists when it comes to their attitudes about gun control. Polls show women are more likely to favor certain gun restrictions. Last month's mass shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, killing 20 first graders and 6 educators, has sparked a nationwide discussion about how to reduce gun violence. Sasha Eslanian stopped by a Twin Cities gun shop on a recent ladies' night to talk with women shooters about how Sandy Hook has influenced their thinking about guns.
All right, ladies, well, let's pick out some guns here.
It's Wednesday night at Bill's Gun Shop and Range in Robbinsdale, and firearms instructor Shalane Krigo goes over safety rules and how to use a gun with a group of 20-something housemates from Brooklyn Center.
Push your butt out a little bit. There you go, just like that.
This is Kayla Olson's first visit to a gun range. The 23-year-old has never shot a gun before.
This is something that was on my bucket list, so one thing crossed off.
Women account for 14% of the permits to carry issued in Minnesota over the past decade. Bill's gun shop owner John Munson says women are the largest untapped market.
You know, for our business, it's probably close to 20%. I will tell you that I see a much larger percentage of women in the store, whether they are buying or they are just supporting. Definitely that number increases every year.
But Munson says he's not surprised by Gallup poll data from late December showing women are much more likely to favor limits on high-capacity magazines, as President Obama is proposing.
Think of the issue at hand. There were children that were hurt. So every one of these women are a mother or a sister or a daughter. They're more sensitive and more feely than guys are. You know, their emotional outbreak is not to say, you can't take mine. It's to say, if I have to give mine up so someone else doesn't have to suffer, then I will.
Munson had a setback in his marketing to women shortly after Sandy Hook. The annual Gals and Guns Gala, planned for tomorrow night, was canceled after KS95, its radio station sponsor, pulled out. KS95 manager Dan Seaman says the timing of the event just didn't feel right after Sandy Hook.
This was not a statement from KS95 on guns. This was a statement really on controversy, and we don't like to get involved in controversial topics, and we're here to entertain and have fun and play Katy Perry songs.
Seaman says the station hasn't ruled out sponsoring a future event on gun safety. Back at Bill's Gun Shop, Sandy Hook has other mothers thinking differently. Christy Nelson of Maple Grove brought her 14-year-old daughter and a friend out for a night of target shooting.
That's good to know, you know, especially with the shootings that have gone on in schools and other areas, that it's better to know how a handgun works and how to use one. And I think if there's a gun involved, whether you're, you know, in a school or a mall or even at a friend's house, if somebody takes the gun out, it's better to know how it works than to know nothing about it.
On the range, the two teens do some considerable damage to their paper target of a scary clown. An adult mother-daughter pair out practicing shooting tonight is Kelly Rearing and her mom Sheila O'Reilly of Minneapolis. Rearing is here to try out an HK-45, a new pistol she's considering buying. She thinks owning a gun is a good thing, within limits.
I still am a firm believer and supporter of the Second Amendment, and I feel like it's a good right for us to have, and it should be supported, but I think that it maybe should be adjusted in the sense that not everybody should be able to have such easy access to it, and gun safety control is very necessary for the sport.
Her mom, Sheila Riley, is an NRA member who owns handguns and rifles and has a permit to carry. But she says Sandy Hook has increased her concern about the widespread availability of guns.
I wish there were more ways to check someone's mental health background. Even though guns can be purchased legally, there's still a lot of people that can get them, and there's no guarantee that they won't have a mental health crisis somewhere down the line.
President Obama's proposals for curbing gun violence this week included several executive orders aimed at improving mental health coverage and strengthening the background check system.
That's reporter Sasha Eslanian, and in the wake of last month's school shooting, rumors spread across the country via Twitter and Facebook that more violence would follow, putting students and parents on edge. But even before that tragedy, Minnesota school officials say they were spending more and more time responding to rumors that spread through social media. Tim Post reports.
Back in December, a student at North Junior High School in Hopkins accidentally cut himself with a craft knife in a technical education class. North Junior High's principal Becky Melville says it was no big deal.
He was sent to the office. We put a Band-Aid on it and sent him back to class.
Melville forgot all about the incident by evening and was settling in at home when...
I got a phone call and an email about a stabbing that had occurred at North.
It took some detective work by Melville to figure out what happened. The same day the student was bandaged up for his run-in with the craft knife, several police cars were spotted outside the school. Rumors began swirling on Twitter and Facebook. There had been a stabbing at the school. It turns out the cops were at the school for another reason. They were taking a few students Christmas shopping for one of those Shop with a Cop events. The next day, Melville had to take to social media herself to put out the word on what really happened.
The only way that you can work with that is to then use that same social media for your benefit to spread the right information as quickly.
It's a situation more and more school officials find themselves in these days. Schools are full of students with smartphones, young journalists of a sort, able to broadcast through posts or tweets whatever happens in school immediately, even if it's not always 100% factual. Of course, rumors at school are nothing new, but social media allows them to spread much faster and further. Linda Madsen is superintendent of the Forest Lake School District.
There's word that gets out before we are actually sure what is happening.
Madsen says on one level, social media is a great way for students to reach out to their parents when something is happening at school. Hey, Mom, there's a lockdown at school. I'm okay. Or something along those lines. But Madsen says that means parents are calling schools to find out what's going on before school officials have gathered all the facts themselves.
Many parents receive some sort of communication prior to what they receive from the school district. But that's just the age that we're living in.
School officials say when it comes to threats of violence, they investigate every rumor they hear, even if their gut instinct tells them it's a hoax. Brett Johnson is spokesman for the Eastern Carver County School District. The district's high school in Chaska closed down for a day last week because a threat of violence via email disrupted the start of the school day.
They know, based on all the history of school threats, that they're most likely hoaxes, but they don't ever take one initially as a hoax. They take it seriously, they evaluate it, they decide what their plan of action is going to be.
Johnson says school officials, with the help of authorities, are getting better at tracing threats, especially those that appear online. Students who make threats, even if they never intended to hurt anyone, could find themselves in trouble. Consequences vary, but often include suspensions and can even involve criminal charges.
That's education reporter Tim Post. The federal government has listed PV Plaza in Minneapolis on the National Register of Historic Places. The move comes as the city and historic preservationists battle in court over the future of the site. The Minneapolis City Council voted last year to demolish PV Plaza, arguing it was obsolete, inaccessible, and conducive to crime. The Washington, D.C.-based Cultural Landscape Foundation is suing to block that demolition. President Charles Birnbaum says having PV on the register strengthens the case to save it.
The city has questioned time and time again the integrity and significance of this landscape, and now we have the highest authority, the keeper of the register, working with the state, approving the designation on January 14th.
A spokesman for Minneapolis issued a written statement saying the listing does not impact the path the city is on. PV Plaza was completed back in 1975. A Hennepin County judge will hear arguments on its future in February. Both the University of Minnesota and North Dakota hockey teams are on hot streaks coming into this weekend series in Minneapolis. The Gophers have lost just once in their last 15 games and are the top-ranked team in the nation. UND has just one loss in its last 9 games. Tonight's and Saturday's games are significant for another reason. It's the last time the two schools will play as members of the Western Collegiate Hockey Association, barring a playoff matchup. It will also be the last time they will play in the regular season for at least a few years. UND next season is moving to the National Collegiate Hockey Conference, while Minnesota is going to the Big Ten. And there are no future games scheduled between the teams. That's the NPR News Update for Friday, January 18th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.